Saleh's body had fought as best it could, and his strength had merely extended the struggle and the pain, like a soldier in a hopeless battle. But his strength had given out, finally, and the body collapsed, and waited for death to come. The alarm chirp on the cardiac monitor went off, and there was nothing to do but flip it off. There would be no reviving this patient. IV leads were removed, and the sharps carefully placed in the red plastic container. Literally everything that had touched the patient would be burned. It wasn't all that remarkable. AIDS and some hepatitis victims were similarly treated as objects of deadly contamination. Just with Ebola, burning the bodies was preferable. And besides, the government had insisted. So, one battle lost. McGregor was relieved, somewhat to his shame, as he stripped off the protective suit for the last time, washed thoroughly, then went to see Sohaila. She was still weak, but ready to leave to complete her recovery. The most recent tests showed her blood full of antibodies. Somehow her system had met the enemy and passed the test. There was no active virus in her. She could be hugged. In another country, she would have been kept in for further tests, and would have donated a good deal of blood for extensive laboratory studies. But again the local government had said that such things would not take place, that she was to be released from the hospital the first minute that it was safe to do so. McGregor had hedged on that, but now he was certain that there would be no more complications. The doctor himself lifted her and placed her in the wheelchair. "When you feel better, will you come back to see me?" he asked with a warm smile. She nodded. A bright child. Her English was good. A pretty child with a charming smile despite her fatigue, glad to be going home. "Doctor?" It was her father. He must have had a military background, so straight of back was he. What he was trying to say was evident on his face before he could even think the words. "I did very little. Your daughter is young and strong, and that is what saved her. Even so, I will not forget this debt." A firm handshake, and McGregor remembered Kipling's line about East and West. Whatever this man was, the doctor had his suspicions. There was a commonality among all men. "She will be weak for another fortnight or so. Let her eat whatever she wants, and best to let her sleep as long as possible." "It will be as you say," Sohaila's father promised. "You have my number, here and at home, if you have any questions at all. And if you have any difficulties with the government, for example, please let me know." The measure of the man's gratitude came across. For what it was worth, McGregor had a protector of sorts. It couldn't hurt, he decided, walking them to the door. Then it was back to his office. "So," the official said after listening to the report, "everything is stabilized." "That is correct." "The staff have been checked?" "Yes, and we will rerun the tests tomorrow to be sure. Both patient rooms will be fully disinfected today. All contaminated items are being burned right now." "The body?" "Also bagged and to be burned, as you directed." "Excellent. Dr. McGregor, you have done well, and I thank you for that. Now we can forget that this unhappy incident ever happened." "But how did the Ebola get here?" McGregor demanded, plaintively, which was as far as he could go. The official didn't know, and so he spoke confidently. "That does not concern you, and it does not concern me. It will not be repeated. Of that I am certain." "As you say." After a few more words, McGregor hung the phone up and stared at the wall. One more fax to CDC, he decided. The government couldn't object to that. He had to tell them that the outbreak, such as it was closed out. And that was a relief, too. Better to go back to the normal practice of medicine, and diseases he could defeat. It turned out that Kuwait had been more forthcoming than Saudi on forwarding the substance of the meeting, perhaps because the Kuwaiti government really was a family business, and their establishment happened to be on a very dangerous street corner. Adler handed the transcript over. The president scanned it quickly.
It reads like, get lost.
You got it, the Secretary of State agreed.
Either Foreign Minister Sabah edited all the polite stuff out, or what he heard scared him. I'm betting on number two, Bert Vasco decided.
Ben? Jack asked.
Dr. Goodley shook his head.
We may have a problem here.
May? Vasco asked. This goes beyond May.
Okay, Bert, you're our champ prognosticator for the Persian Gulf, the president observed. How about another forecast?
The culture over there is one of bargaining. There are elaborate verbal rituals for important meetings. Hi, how are you? Can take an hour. If we're to believe that such things did not take place, there's a message in their absence.
You said it, Mr. President. Get lost.
Though it was interesting, Vasco thought, that they'd begun by praying together. Perhaps that was a signal that had meant something to the Saudis but not to the Kuwaitis. Even he didn't know every aspect of the local culture.
Then why are the Saudis low-keying this?
You told me that Prince Ali gave you another impression?
Ryan nodded.
That's right. Go on.
The kingdom is a little schizophrenic. They like us, and they trust us as strategic partners, but they also dislike us and distrust us as a culture. It's not even that simple. It goes round and round. But they're afraid that too much exposure to the West will adversely affect their society. They're highly conservative on what we call social issues, like when our army was over there in 91, and they requested that army chaplains remove the religious insignia from their uniforms, and seeing women drive cars and carry guns drove them a little nuts.
So, on one hand, they depend on us as guarantor of their security. Prince Ali keeps asking you about that, right? But on the other hand, they worry that in protecting them we might mess up their country. It keeps coming back to religion.
They'd probably prefer to make a deal with Darii than to have to invite us back to guard their border. And so the majority of their government is going to run down that track in the knowledge that we will come in if asked. Kuwait's going to be a different story. If we ask to be allowed to stage an exercise, they'll say yes in a heartbeat, even if the Saudis ask them not to.
Good news, Darii knows that, and he can't move all that fast. If he starts moving troops south...
The agency will give us warning, Goodley said confidently. We know what to look for, and they're not sophisticated enough to hide it.
If we run troops into Kuwait now, it will be perceived as an aggressive act, Adler warned. Better we should meet with Darii first and sound him out.
Just so we give him the right signal, Vasco put in.
Oh, we won't make that mistake. And I think he knows that the status of the Gulf countries is a top-drawer item with us. No mixed signals this time.
Ambassador April Glaspie had been accused of giving such a signal to Saddam Hussein in the summer of 1990. But she denied Hussein's account, and the latter wasn't all that reliable a source of information. Maybe it had been a linguistic nuance. Most likely of all, he'd heard exactly what he'd wanted to hear, and not what had actually been said, a habit frequently shared by heads of state and children.
"How fast can you set it up?" the president asked.
"Pretty fast," the Secretary of State replied.
"Do it," Ryan ordered. "All possible speed.
Ben?"
"Yes, sir."
"I talked with Robbie Jackson already. Coordinate with him for a plan to get a modest security force rapid deployed over there. Enough to show that we're interested, not enough to provoke them. Let's also call Kuwait and tell them that we're here if they need us, and that we can deploy to their country if they so request. Who's on deck for this?"
24th Mech, Fort Stewart, Georgia.
"I checked," Goodley said, rather proud of himself.
"Their 2nd Brigade is on rotating alert status now. Also a brigade of the 82nd at Fort Bragg. With the equipment warehoused in Kuwait, we can do the match-up and be rolling in as little as 48 hours. I'd also advise increasing the readiness state of the maritime pre-positioning ships at Diego Garcia. That we can do quietly."
"Nice job, Ben.
Call the SecDef and tell him I want it done. Quietly."
"Yes, Mr. President."
"I'll tell Darii that we offer a friendly hand to the United Islamic Republic," Adler said. "Also that we are committed to peace and stability in that region, and that means territorial integrity.
I wonder what he'll say.
Eyes turned to Bert Vasco, who was learning to curse his newly acquired status as resident genius.
He might just have wanted to rattle their cage. I don't think he wants to rattle ours.
That's your first hedge, Ryan observed.
Not enough information, Vasco replied.
I don't see that he wants a conflict with us. That happened once and everybody watched.
Yes, he doesn't like us. Yes, he doesn't like the Saudis or any of the other states. But no, he doesn't want to take us on.
Maybe he could knock them all off.
That's a military call, and I'm just an FSO.
But not with us in the game, and he knows it. So political pressure on Kuwait and the kingdom, sure. Beyond that, however, I don't see enough to be worried about.
Yet, the president added.
Yes, sir. Yet, Vasco agreed.
Am I leaning on you too hard, Bert?
It's okay, Mr. President. At least you listen to me. It wouldn't hurt for us to generate a special national intelligence estimate of the UIR's full capabilities and intentions. I need broader access to what the intel community's generating.
Jack turned.
Ben, the SNI is ordered. Bert's on the team with full access by my order.
You know, guys, giving orders can be fun, the president added, with a smile to break up the tension that the meeting had generated.
This is a potential problem, but not a ballbuster yet, correct?
There were nods.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Let's keep an eye on this one.
Singapore Airlines Flight 26 landed 5 minutes later, coming to the terminal at 10:25 a.m. The first-class passengers, having enjoyed wider, softer seats, now enjoyed quicker access to the entry rigmarole which America inflicts on her visitors. The traveler recovered his two-seater from the carousel, and with his carry-on slung on his other shoulder, picked a line to stand in. In his hand held his entry card, which declared nothing of interest to the United States government. The truth would not have been pleasing to them in any case.
"Hello," the inspector said, taking the card and scanning it.
The passport came next. It seemed an old one, its pages liberally covered with exit and entry stamps. He found a blank page and prepared to make a new mark.
"Purpose of your visit to America?"
"Business," the traveler replied. "I am here for the auto show at Javits Center."
"Uh-huh."
The inspector had scarcely heard the answer. The stamp was placed, and the visitor pointed to another line. There his bags were X-rayed instead of opened.
"Anything to declare?"
"No." Simple answers were best. Another inspector looked at the TV display of the bag and saw nothing interesting. The traveler was waved through, and he collected his bags from the conveyor and walked out to where the taxis were.
Amazing, he thought, finding a place in another line, and getting into a cab in less than 5 minutes.
His first concern, being caught at the customs checkpoint, was behind him. For his next, the taxi he was in could not have been pre-selected for him. He'd fumbled with his bags and let a woman go ahead of him in order to keep that from happening. Now he slumped back in his seat and made a show of looking around, while in reality looking to see if there was a car following the cab into town. The pre-lunchtime traffic was so dense that it hardly seemed possible, all the more so that he was in one of thousands of yellow vehicles, darting in and out of traffic like cattle in a stampede. About the only bad news was that his hotel was sufficiently far from the convention center that he'd need another cab. Well, that couldn't be helped, and he needed to check in first anyway. Another 30 minutes and he was in the hotel, in the elevator, going up to the sixth floor. A helpful bellman holding his two-seater, while the traveler retained his carry-on. He tipped the bellman $2. He'd been briefed on what to tip. Better to give a modest one than to be remembered as one who'd tipped too much or not at all, which was taken with gratitude, but not too much. With his entry tasks complete, the traveler unpacked his suits and shirts, also removing extraneous items from his carry-on. The shaving kit he left in, using what the hotel provided to reshave his bristly face after a cleansing shower. Despite the tension, he was amazed at how good he felt. He'd been on the go for, what, 22 hours?
something like that. But he'd gotten a lot of sleep, and air travel didn't make him anxious, as it did for so many. He ordered lunch from the room service menu, then dressed, and, slinging his carry-on over his shoulder, walked downstairs and got a cab for the Javits Center. The auto show, he thought. He'd always liked cars. Behind him, in space and time, most of the 19 others were still in the air. Some were just landing. Boston first, then more in New York, and one at Dulles. To make their own way through customs, testing their knowledge and their luck against the great Satan, or whatever rubbish Darii termed their collective enemy. Satan, after all, had great powers and was worthy of respect. Satan could look in a man's eyes and see his thoughts, almost as Allah could. No, these Americans were functionaries, only dangerous to them if given warning.
"You have to know how to read people," Clark told them. It was a good class. Unlike people in a conventional school, they all wanted to learn. It almost took him back to his own days here at the farm, at the height of the Cold War, when everyone had wanted to be James Bond and actually believed a little in it despite everything the instructors had said. Most of his classmates had been recent college grads, well-educated from books, but not yet from life. Most had learned pretty well. Some hadn't. And the flunking grade out in the field could be more than a red mark on a blue book. But mainly it had been less dramatic than what they showed in the movies. Just the realization that it was time for a career change. Clark had higher hopes for this bunch. Maybe they hadn't arrived with degrees in history from Dartmouth or Brown, but they had studied something, somewhere, then learned more on the streets of some big cities. Maybe they even knew that everything they learned would be important to them someday.
"Will they lie to us? Our agents, I mean?"
"You're from Pittsburgh, Mr. Stone, right?"
"Yes, sir."
"You worked confidential informants on the street. They ever lie to you?"
"Sometimes," Stone admitted.
"There's your answer. They will lie about their importance, the danger they're in, damn near anything, depending on how they feel today. You have to know them and know their moods. Stone, did you know when your informants were telling sea stories?"
"Most of the time."
"How did you tell?" Clark asked.
"Whenever they know a little too much, whenever it doesn't fit."
"You know," their instructor observed with a grin, "you people are so smart that sometimes I wonder what I'm doing here. It's about knowing people. In your careers at the agency, you will always be running into folks who think they can tell it all from overheads. The satellite knows all and tells all."
"Not exactly," Clark went on.
"Satellites can be fooled, and it's easier than people like to admit. People have their weaknesses, too, ego foremost among them, and there is never a substitute for looking them in the eyes. But the nice thing about working agents in the field is even their lies will reveal some of the truth to you. Case in point, Moscow, Kutuzovsky Prospect, 1983. This agent we brought out, and he'll be here next week for you to meet. He was having a hard time with his boss, and—" Chavez appeared at the back door and held up a phone message form. Clark hurried through the rest of the lesson and handed the class over to his assistant.
"What is it, Ding?" John asked.
"Mary Pat wants us up in D.C. in a hurry. Something about a SNI."
"The United Islamic Republic, I bet."
"Hardly worth taking the message down, Mr. C.," Chavez observed. "They want us up in time for dinner. Want me to drive?" There were four maritime prepositioning ships at Diego Garcia. They were relatively new ships, built for their purpose, which was to be floating parking garages for military vehicles. A third of those were tanks, mobile artillery, and armored personnel carriers, and the rest were the less dramatic trains, vehicles preloaded with everything from ammunition to rations to water. The ships were painted navy gray, but with colored bands around their funnels to designate them as part of the National Defense Reserve Fleet, crewed by merchant sailors whose job was to maintain them. That wasn't overly difficult.
Every few months they'd light off the huge diesel engines and sail around for a few hours, just to be absolutely sure everything worked. This evening they got a new message to increase their alert status. One by one, the engine room crews went below and fired up the engines. Fuel quantities were verified against written records, and various benchmark tests made to ensure that the ship was ready to sail, which was why they were maintained so lovingly. Testing the engines was not abnormal. Testing all at the same time was, and the collection of monster engines made for a thermal bloom that was obvious to infrared detectors overhead, especially at night. That came to the attention of Sergei Golovko within 30 minutes of its detection, and, like intelligence chiefs all over the world, he assembled a team of specialists to discuss it.
"Where is the American carrier battle group?" he asked first of all.
America loved to throw them around the oceans of the world.
"They left the atoll yesterday, heading east."
"Away from the Persian Gulf?"
"Correct. They have exercises scheduled with Australia. It's called Southern Cup. We have no information to suggest that the exercise is being cancelled."
"Then why exercise their troop ships?"
The analyst gestured.
"It could be an exercise, but the turmoil in the Persian Gulf suggests otherwise."
"Nothing in Washington?" Golovko asked.
"Our friend Ryan continues to navigate the political rapids," the chief of the American political section reported. "Badly."
"Will he survive?"
"Our ambassador believes so, and the resident concurs, but neither thinks he is firmly in command. It's a classic muddle. America has always prided herself on the smooth transition of government power, but their laws did not anticipate such events as we have seen. He cannot move decisively against his political enemy."
"What Kielty is doing is state treason," Golovko observed,
the penalty for which, in Russia, had always been severe. Even the phrase was enough to lower the temperature of a room.
"Not according to their law. But my legal experts tell me that the issue is sufficiently confused that there will be no clear winner, and in such a case Ryan remains in command because of his position. He got there first."
Golovko nodded, but his expression was decidedly unhappy. Red October and the Gerasimov business should never have become public knowledge. He and his government had known the latter, but only suspected the former. On the submarine business, American security had been superb. So that was the card Ryan had played to make Kolya defect. It had to be. It all made sense from the distance of time, and a fine play it had been. Except for one thing. It had become public knowledge in Russia as well, and he was now forbidden to contact Ryan directly until the diplomatic fallout had been determined. America was doing something. He did not yet know what that was, and instead of calling to ask, and perhaps even getting a truthful answer, he'd have to wait for his field officers to discern it on their own. The problem lay in the harm that had been done to the American government, and in Ryan's own habit, learned at CIA, of working with a small number of people instead of playing the entire bureaucracy like a symphony orchestra. Instinct told him that Ryan would be cooperative. He'd trust former enemies to act in collective self-interest. But one thing the traitor Kielty had accomplished—who else could have told the American press those stories—was to create a political impasse. Politics. Politics had once been the center of Golovko's life. A party member since the age of 18, he'd studied his Lenin and Marx with all the fervor of a theology student. And though the fervor had changed over time to something else, those logical but foolish theories had shaped his adult life, until they'd evaporated, leaving him at least a profession at which he excelled. He'd been able to rationalize his previous antipathy to America in historical terms, two great powers, two great alliances, two differing philosophies acting in perverse unison to create the last great world conflict. National pride still wished that his nation had won. But the Rodina hadn't, and that was that. The important part was that the Cold War was over, and with it the deadly confrontation between America and his country. Now they could actually recognize their common interests, and at times act in cooperation. It had actually happened already. Ivan Nemetovich Ryan had come to him for help in the American conflict with Japan, and together the two countries had accomplished a vital goal, something still secret. Why the hell, Golovko thought, couldn't the traitor Keelty have revealed that secret instead of the others? But no. Now his country was embarrassed, and while the newly freed media had as great a field day with this story as the Americans were having, or even more, he was unable to make a simple phone call. Those ships were turning their engines for a reason. Ryan was doing something or thinking about doing something, and instead of merely asking, he had to be a spy again, working against another spy instead of working with an ally. Well, he had no choice.
Form a special study group for the Persian Gulf. Everything we have, bring it together as quickly as possible. America will have to react somehow to the developing situation. First, we must determine what is happening. Second, what America probably knows. Third, what America will do. That general, G.I. Bondarenko, get him involved. He just spent time with their military. Immediately, Comrade Chairman, his principal deputy replied for the rest of the meeting. At least that hadn't changed.
Conditions, he thought, were excellent. Not too hot, not too cold. The Javits Center was right on the river, and that made for relatively high local humidity, and that was good also. He'd be inside, and so there was no concern about ultraviolet radiation harming the contents of his container. For the rest, the theory of what he was doing was not his concern. He'd been briefed on it, and would do exactly what he'd been told. Whether or not it worked, well, that was in Allah's hands, wasn't it? The traveler got out of his cab and walked in. He'd never been in so capacious a building, and there was a little disorientation after he got his visitor's badge and program book, which showed a map of the interior. With that came an index that allowed him to see the location of various exhibits, and with a muted smile, he decided that he had hours to accomplish his goal, and would spend the time looking at cars just like everybody else. There were lots of them, sparkling like jewels, some on turntables for those too lazy to walk around them, many with scantily clad women gesturing at them as though one might have sexual relations with them. The cars, that is. Though some of the women might be possibilities, he thought, watching their faces with concealed amusement. He'd known intellectually that America made millions of cars, and in almost that many shapes and colors. It seemed hugely wasteful. What was a car, after all, except for a method of moving from one place to another? And in the course of use they got damaged and dirty. And the show here was a lie in that it showed them as they would be for less time than it took to drive one home, even in America, as he'd seen in the drive here from his hotel. But it was a pleasant experience, even so. He would have thought of it as shopping, but this was not the souk which he connected with the process, not an alley full of small shops operated by merchants for whom bargaining was as important as the air. No, America was different. Here they prostituted women to sell things for a predetermined price. It wasn't that he was personally against such use of women. The traveler was not married, and had the usual carnal desires. But to proclaim it in this way attacked the puritanical modesty of his culture. And so while he never once looked away from the women standing by the cars, he was glad that none of them was from his part of the world. All the makes and models. Cadillac had a huge display in the General Motors section. Ford had another area of its own for all of its trademark products. He wandered through the Chrysler section, and then off to the foreign makers. The Japanese section, he saw, was being avoided, doubtless as a result of the American conflict in that country, though above many of the displays were signs proclaiming, "Made in America by Americans," in 3-meter letters to those few who seemed to care. Toyota, Nissan, and the rest would have a bad year, even the sporty Cressida, regardless of where they might be assembled. You could tell that by the lack of people in the area. And with that realization, his interest in Asian cars died. No, he decided, not around here. European cars were profiting from Japan's misfortune, he saw. Mercedes especially was drawing a huge crowd, especially a new model of their most expensive sports car, painted a glossy midnight black that reflected the overhead lighting like a piece of the clear desert sky. Along the way, the traveler picked up a brochure at every booth from a friendly manufacturer's representative. These he tucked into his carry-on bag so as to make himself look like every other visitor. He found a food booth and got something to eat. It was a hot dog, and he didn't worry if it had pork in it or not. America wasn't an Islamic country, after all, and he didn't have to worry about such things. He spent a good deal of time looking at all-terrain vehicles, first wondering if they'd survive the primitive roads of Lebanon and Iran, and deciding that they probably would. One was based on a military type he'd seen before, and if he'd had a choice, it would have been that one, wide and powerful. He got the entire publicity package for that one, then leaned against a post so that he might read it. Sports cars were for the effete. This was something of substance. What a pity he'd never own one. He checked his watch. Early evening. More visitors were crowding in as work let out and people took the evening to indulge their fantasies. Perfect. Along the way, he'd noted the air conditioning. It would have been better to set his canister in the system itself, but he'd been briefed on that, too. The Legionnaires' disease outbreak years before in Philadelphia had taught Americans about the need for keeping such systems clean. They often used chlorine to treat the condensate water, which humidified the recirculating air, and chlorine would kill the virus as surely as a bullet killed a man. Looking up from the color-printed brochure, he noted the huge circular vents. Cool air descended from them and washed invisibly along the floor. On being heated by the bodies in the room, the warm air would rise back into the returns and go through the system for cooling and some degree of disinfection. So he had to pick a spot where the airflow would be his ally, not his enemy, and he considered that, standing there like an interested car shopper.
He started wandering more, walking under some of the vents, feeling the gentle, cooling breeze with his skin, evaluating one and another, and looking for a good spot to leave his canister. The latter was equally important. The spray period would last for about 15 seconds. There would be a hissing sound, probably lost in the noise of the crowded building, and a brief fog. The cloud would turn invisible in just a few more seconds. The particulate matter was so small and, being as dense as the surrounding air, would become part of the ambient atmosphere and spread around randomly for at least 30 minutes, perhaps more, depending on the efficiency of the environmental systems in the center. He wanted to expose as many people as possible, consistent with those parameters, and with that renewed thought in his mind, he started wandering again. It helped that, vast as the auto show was, it did not fill the Javits Center. Every exhibit was constructed of prefabricated parts like those in a business office, and behind many of those were large swatches of cloth, like vertical banners, whose only purpose was to break up the line of sight to empty portions of the building. They were easily accessible, the traveler saw. Nothing was fenced off. You simply ducked around an exhibit. He saw some people holding mini-meetings there, and some circulating maintenance personnel, but little else. The maintenance personnel were a potential problem, though. It wouldn't do to have his canister picked up before it discharged. But such people would be on regular routines, wouldn't they? It was just a matter of discerning the patterns of their movement. Of course. So, he thought, where is the best spot? The show would be open for several more hours. He wanted to pick a perfect place and time, but he'd been briefed not to worry too greatly about that. He took that advice to heart. Better to be covert. That was his primary mission. The main entrance is there. The people entered and left through the same side of the building. Emergency exits were everywhere, all of them properly marked, but with alarm buzzers on them. At the entrance was a bank of air conditioning vents to form a thermal barrier of sorts, and the returns were mainly in the center of the exhibit hall. So the airflow was designed to move inward from the periphery, and everyone had to come in and out the same way. How to make that work for him? A bank of restrooms was on that side, with regular traffic back and forth. Too dangerous. Someone might see the can and pick it up and put it in a trash can. He walked to the other side, fumbling with his program as he did so, bumping into people, and finding himself again at the edge of the General Motors section. Beyond that were Mercedes and BMW, all on the way to the returns. And there were lots of people in all three areas. Plus the downward bloom of the air would wash across part of the entrance exit. The green banners blocked view of the wall, but there was space under them, open area, partially shielded from view. This was it. He walked away, checking his watch, and then the program for the show's hours. The program he tucked into the carry-on bag, while his other hand unzipped the shaving kit. He circulated around one more time, looking for another likely place. And while he found one, it wasn't as good as the first. Then he made a final check to see if someone might be following him. No, nobody knew he was here. And he wouldn't announce his presence or his mission with a burst from an AK-47 or the crash of a tossed grenade. There was more than one way to be a terrorist, and he regretted not having discovered this one sooner. How much he might have enjoyed setting a canister like this one into a theater in Jerusalem. But no, the time for that would come later, perhaps, once the main enemy of his culture was crippled. He looked at the faces now, these Americans who so hated him and his people, shuffling around like cattle, purposeless. And then it was time. The traveler ducked behind an exhibit, extracted the can, and set it on its side on the concrete floor. It was weighted to roll to the proper position, and, lying on its side, it would be harder to see. With that done, he pressed the simple mechanical timer and walked away, back into the exhibition area, turning left to leave the building. He was in a taxi in 5 minutes, on the way back to his hotel. Before he got there, the timer spring released the valve, and for 15 seconds the canister emptied its contents into the air. The noise was lost in the cacophony of the crowd. The vapor cloud dispersed before it could be seen. In Atlanta, it was the spring boat show. About half of the people there might have serious thoughts of buying a boat, this year or some other. The rest were just dreaming. Let them dream, this traveler thought on the way out. In Orlando, it was recreational vehicles. That was particularly easy. A traveler looked under a Winnebago, as though to check the chassis, slid his canister there, and left. In Chicago's McCormick Center, it was housewares, a vast hall full of every manner of furniture and appliance, and the women who wished to have them. In Houston, it was one of America's greatest horse shows. Many of them were Arabians, he was surprised to note, and the traveler whispered a prayer that the disease didn't hurt those noble creatures so beloved of Allah. In Phoenix, it was golf equipment, a game that the traveler didn't know a thing about, though he had several kilos of free literature which he might read on the flight back to the Eastern Hemisphere. He'd found an empty golf bag with a hard plastic lining that would conceal the canister, set the timer, and dropped it in. In San Francisco, it was computers, the most crowded show of all that day, with over 20,000 people in the Moscone Convention Center, so many that this traveler feared he might not get outside to the garden area before the can released its contents. But he did, walking upwind to his hotel, 4 blocks away, his job complete. The rug shop was just closing down when Arif Rehman walked in. Mr. Alahad locked the front door and switched off the lights. My instructions?
You will do nothing without direct orders, but it is important to know if you are able to complete your mission.
Is that not plain? Raymond asked in irritation. Why do you think—
I have my instructions, Alahad said gently.
I am able. I am ready, the assassin assured his cutout.
The decision had been made years before, but it was good to say it out loud to another, here, now.
You will be told at the proper time. It will be soon.
The political situation,
we are aware of that, and we are confident of your devotion.
Be at peace, Arif. Great things are happening. I know not what they are, merely that they are underway, and at the proper time your act will be the capstone of the holy jihad. Mahmud Haji sends his greetings and his prayers.
Thank you.
Rayman inclined his head at word of the distant but powerful blessing. It had been a very long time since he'd heard the man's voice over anything but a television, and then he'd been forced to turn away lest others see his reaction to it.
It has been hard for you, Alahad said.
It has, Rayman nodded.
It will soon be over, my young friend. Come to the back with me. Do you have time?
I do.
It is time for prayer.
Chapter 38 Grace Period.
I'm not an area specialist, Clark objected. He'd been to Iran before.
Ed Foley would have none of that.
You've been on the ground there, and I think you're the one who always talks about how there's no substitute for dirty hands and a good nose.
He was just laying more of that on the kiddies at the farm this afternoon, Ding reported with a sly look. Well, today it was about reading people by looking in their eyes, but it's the same thing. Good eye, good nose, good senses.
He hadn't been to Iran, and they wouldn't send Mr. C alone, would they?
You're in, John, Mary Pat Foley said. And since she was the DDO, that was that. Secretary Adler may be flying over real soon. I want you and Ding to go over as SPOs. Keep him alive and sniff around, nothing covert or anything. I want your read on what the street feels like. That's all, just a quick recon.
It was the sort of thing usually done by watching footage on CNN, but Mary Pat wanted an experienced officer to take the local pulse, and it was her call.
If there were a curse in being a good training officer, it was that the people you trained often got promoted and remembered their lessons. And worse, who'd taught them. Clark could recall both of the Foleys in his classes at the farm. From the start, she'd been the cowboy, well, cowgirl of the pair, with brilliant instincts, fantastically good Russian skills, and the sort of gift for reading people more often found in a professor of psychiatry. But somewhat wanting in caution, trusting a little too much on the baby blues and dumb blonde act to keep her safe. Ed lacked her passion, but had the ability to formulate the big picture, to take a long view that made sense most of the time. Neither was quite perfect. Together they were a piece of work, and John took pride in having taught them his way. Most of the time.
Okay, we have anything in the way of assets over there?
Nothing useful. Adler wants to eyeball Darii and tell him what the rules are. You'll be quartered in the French embassy. The trip is secret. VC-20 to Paris, French transport from there. In and out in a hurry, Mary Pat told them. But I want you to spend an hour or two walking around, just to get a feel for things. Price of bread, how people dress, you know the drill.
And we'll have diplomatic passports so nobody can hassle us, John added wryly.
Yeah, I heard that one before. So did everyone else in the embassy back in 1979, remember?
Adler, Secretary of State, Ed reminded him.
I think they know that. They know he's Jewish, too, he didn't add.
The flight into Barstow, California, was how the exercise always started. Buses and trucks rolled up to the airplanes, and the troops came down the stairs for the short drive up the only road into the NTC. General Diggs and Colonel Ham watched from their parked helicopter as the soldiers formed up. This group was from the North Carolina National Guard, a reinforced brigade. It wasn't often that the Guard came to Fort Irwin, and this one was supposed to be pretty special. Because the state was blessed with very senior senators and congressmen, well, until recently, over the years, the men from Carolina had gotten the very best in modern equipment and been designated a round-out brigade for one of the regular Army's armored divisions. Sure enough, they strutted like real soldiers, and their officers had been prepping for a year in anticipation of this training rotation. They'd even managed to get their hands on additional fuel with which they'd trained a few extra weeks. Now the officers formed their men up in regular lines before putting them on the transport, and from a distance of a quarter mile, Diggs and Ham could see their officers talking to their men over the noise of the arriving aircraft.
"They look proud, boss," Ham observed.
They heard a distant shout as a company of tankers told their captain they were ready to kick some ass. A news crew was even out there to immortalize the event for local TV.
"They are proud," the general said.
"Soldiers should be proud, Colonel."
"Only one thing missing, sir."
"What's that, Al?"
"Bah," Colonel Ham said around his cigar.
"Lambs to the slaughter."
The two officers shared a look. The first mission of the Op 4 was to take away that pride. The Black Horse Cav had never lost so much as a single simulated engagement to anything other than a regular formation, and that rarely enough. Ham didn't plan to start this month. Two battalions of Abrams tanks, one more of Bradley's, another of artillery, a cavalry company, and a combat support battalion against his three squadrons of opposing force. It hardly seemed fair. For the visitors. They were almost done. The most annoying work of all was mixing the AMFO, which turned out to be a pretty good upper body workout for the mountain men. The proper proportions of the fertilizer, which was mainly an ammonia-based chemical compound, and the diesel fuel came from a book. It struck both men as amusing that plants should like to eat a deadly explosive. The propellant used in artillery rounds was also ammonia-based, and once upon a time in post-World War I Germany, a chemical plant making fertilizer had exploded and wiped out the neighboring village. The addition of diesel fuel was partly to provide an additional element of chemical energy, but mainly to act as a wetting agent, the better for the internal shock wave to propagate within the explosive mass and hasten the detonation. They used a large tub for the mixing, and an oar, like a canoe's, to stir the mass into the proper consistency. That came from a book also. The result was a large glob of mud-like slurry which formed into blocks of a sort. These they lifted by hand. It was dirty and smelly and a little dangerous inside the drum of the cement truck. They took turns doing the filling. The access hatch, which was designed to admit semi-liquid cement, was just over 3 feet in diameter. Holbrook had rigged an electric fan to blow fresh air into the drum, because the fumes from the fresh AMFO mix were unpleasant and possibly dangerous. It gave them headaches, which was warning enough. It was the work of over a week, but now the drum was as filled as they needed it to be, about 3/4, when the last block was nested in with all the rest. Every layer had been somewhat uneven, and the void spaces were filled with a mix that was more liquid and had been handed in by bucket, so that the circular body of the drum was as full as two men working alone could make it. If one could have seen through the steel, it would have looked like a pie chart, the unfilled part of V-shape facing upwards.
"I think that does it, Pete," Ernie Brown said. "We have about another 100 pounds or so, but..."
"No place for it to go," Holbrook agreed, climbing out.
They clambered down the ladder, and the two walked outside, sat in lawn chairs, and got some fresh air.
"Damn, I'm glad that's done."
"You bet."
Brown rubbed his face and took a deep breath. His head hurt so badly that he wondered if his face might come off. They'd stay out here for a long while until they got all those goddamned fumes out of their lungs.
"This has got to be bad for us," Pete said.
"Sure as hell gonna be bad for somebody. Good idea on the bullets," he added.
There were two oil drums full of them inside, probably too many, but that was okay.
"What's a brownie without some walnuts?" Holbrook asked.
"You bastard!"
Brown laughed so hard he nearly came out of the chair.
"Oh, Jesus, my head hurts."
Approval for French cooperation on the meeting came from the Quai d'Orsay with remarkable speed. France had diplomatic interests with every country bordering on the Gulf that connected to all manner of commercial relationships, from tanks to pharmaceuticals. French troops had deployed in the Persian Gulf War to find themselves fighting against French products, but that sort of thing wasn't all that unusual. It made for lots of markets. Approval of the mission was phoned to the American ambassador at 9 in the morning, who telexed Foggy Bottom in less than 5 minutes, where it was relayed to Secretary Adler while he was still in his bed. Action officers made other notifications, first of all to the 89th Military Airlift Wing at Andrews Air Force Base. Getting the Secretary of State out of town quietly was never the easiest of tasks. People tended to notice empty offices of that magnitude, and so an easy cover story was laid on. Adler was going to consult with European allies on several issues. The French were far better able to control their media, a task which was more than anything else a matter of timing. "Yeah," Clark said, lifting the phone at the Marriott closest to Langley. "It's on for today," the voice said. A blink, a shake of the head. "Super. Okay, I'm packed." Then he rolled back over for some more sleep. At least there didn't have to be a mission brief for this one. Keep an eye on Adler, take a walk, and come home. There wasn't any real worry about security. If the Iranians, UIRians was a phrase he hadn't come to terms with yet, wanted to do something, two men with pistols wouldn't be able to do much about it except hand their weapons over unused, and either locals or Iranian security would keep the hostile peons away. He was going to be there for show because it was something you did for some reason or other. "We going?" Chavez asked from the other bed. "Yep. Bueno." Daryai checked his desk clock, subtracting 8, 9, 10, and 11 hours, and wondering if anything had gone wrong. Second thoughts were the bane of people in his position. You made your decisions and took the action, and only then did you really worry, despite all the planning and thought that might have gone into what you did. There was no royal road to success. You had to take risks, a fact never appreciated by those who merely thought about being a chief of state. No, nothing had gone wrong. He'd received the French ambassador, a very pleasant unbeliever, who spoke the local language so beautifully that Daryai wondered what it might be like to have him read some of his country's poetry. And a courtly man, ever polite and deferential, he'd posed his second-hand request like a man arranging a marriage of family alliance, his hopeful smile also conveying the wishes of his government. The Americans would not have made the request if they'd had any pre-warning of Badrine's people and their mission. No, in a case like that, the meeting would have been on neutral ground. Switzerland was always a possibility, for informal but direct contact. In this case, they would send their own foreign minister into what they had to consider to be enemy country, and a Jew at that. Friendly contact, friendly exchange of views, friendly offers of friendly relations, the Frenchman had said, pitching the meeting, doubtless hoping that if it went well, then France would be remembered as the country that fostered a new friendship. Well, maybe a working relationship. And if the meeting went badly, then all that would be remembered was that France had tried to be an honest broker. Had Daryai known about ballet, he would have used it as a visual image for the exchange. Damn the French anyway, he thought. Had their warrior chief Martel not stopped Abdur Rahman in 732 at Poitiers, then the whole world might be. But even Allah couldn't change history. Rahman had lost that battle because his men had grown greedy, fallen away from the purity of the faith. Exposed to the riches of the West, they'd stopped fighting and started looting, and given Martel's forces the chance to reform and counterattack. Yes, that was the lesson to be remembered. There was always time for looting.
You had to win the battle first. First, destroy the enemy's forces, and then take that which you wanted to take.
He walked from his office into the next room. There on the wall was a map of his new country and its neighbors, and a comfortable seat from which to view it. There came the usual error from looking at maps. Distances were truncated. Everything seemed so close, all the more so after all the lost time of his life. Close enough to reach, close enough to grasp. Nothing could go wrong now, not with everything so close. Leaving was easier than arriving. Like most Western countries, America was more concerned with what people might bring in than what they might take out, and properly so, the first traveler thought, as his passport was processed at JFK. It was 7:05 a.m., and Air France Flight 1, a supersonic Concorde, was waiting to take him part of the way home. He had a huge collection of auto brochures, and a story he'd spent some time concocting should anyone ask about them, but his cover wasn't challenged, or even examined. He was leaving, and that was okay. The passport was duly stamped. The customs agent didn't even ask why he had come one day and left the next. Business travelers were business travelers. Besides, it was early in the morning, and nothing important happened before 10. The Air France first-class lounge served coffee, but the traveler didn't want any. He was almost done. Only now did his body want to tremble. It was amazing how easily it had gone. Badrine's mission brief had told them how easy it would be, but he hadn't quite believed it, used as he was to dealing with Israeli security with their numberless soldiers and guns. After all the tension he'd felt, like being wrapped tightly with rope, it was all diminishing now. He'd slept poorly in his hotel the previous night, and now he'd get on the aircraft and sleep all the way across. On getting back to Tehran, he'd look at Badrine and laugh and ask for another such mission. On passing the buffet, he saw a bottle of champagne and poured himself a glass. It made him sneeze, and it was contrary to his religion, but it was the Western way to celebrate, and indeed he had something to celebrate. 20 minutes later, his flight was called, and he walked off to the jetway with the others. His only concern now was jet lag. The flight would leave at 8 sharp, then arrive in Paris at 5:45 p.m. From breakfast to dinner, without the intervening midday meal. Well, such was the miracle of modern travel. They drove separately to Andrews, Adler in his official car, Clark and Chavez in the latter's personal auto. And while the Secretary of State was waved through the gate, the CIA officers had to show ID, which at least earned them a salute from the armed airmen. "You really don't like the place, do you?" the junior officer asked. "Well, Domingo, back when you were taking the training wheels off your bike, I was in Tehran with a cover so thin you could read an insurance policy through it, yelling death to America with the Gomers, and watching our people being paraded around blindfolded by a bunch of crazy kids with guns. For a while there, I thought they were going to be lined up against a wall and hosed. I knew the station chief. Hell, I recognized him. They had him in the bag, too, gave him a rough time." Just standing there, he remembered, only 50 yards away, not able to do a damn thing. "What were you doing?" First time, it was a quick recon for the agency. Second time, it was to be part of the rescue mission that went tits up at Desert One. We all thought it was bad luck at the time, but that operation really scared me. Probably better it failed, John concluded. At least we got them all out alive in the end. "So, bad memories? You don't like the place?" Clark shrugged. "Not really. Never figured them out. The Saudis, I understand. I like them a lot. Once you get through the crust, they make friends for life. Some of the rules are a little funny to us, but that's okay. Kind of like old movies, sense of honor and all that. Hospitality," he went on. "Anyway, lots of good experiences there. Not on the other side of the Gulf. Just as soon leave that place alone." Ding parked his car. Both men retrieved their bags as a sergeant came up to them. "Going to Paris, Sarge," Clark said, holding up his ID again.
You gentlemen want to come with me?
She waved them towards the VIP terminal. The low, one-story building had been cleared of other distinguished visitors. Scott Adler was on one of the couches, going over some papers.